Anderson, you're...
Mr. Justice White, I want to make sure that I made myself clear in answering your question earlier. If the court should decide, contrary to our submission, that specific intent is an element of voluntariness, it would still, in our view, have to address the other two questions, namely
both of them,
although, as we say in our brief, we would not defend the constitutionality of the presumption in those circumstances. But the question would still be whether clear and convincing evidence is required of voluntariness or whether the statute is constitutional. and we presume the court would address the presumption, even though we don't defend it. I think our position is best stated by Chief Justice Warren in his dissent in the Perez case, which, as I noted, was specifically approved by the court in Afroyim. We think that this court should recognize, as Chief Justice Warren did, and I quote, the principle that conduct of a citizen showing a voluntary transfer of allegiance is an abandonment of citizenship, and thus that any action defined by statute by which the citizen manifests allegiance to a foreign state may be so inconsistent with retention of citizenship as to result in a loss of that status, end quote. If the conduct described in the statute manifests what Chief Justice Warren called a dilution of undivided allegiance sufficient to show voluntary abandonment of citizenship, end quote, then the government may give formal recognition to the inevitable consequence of the citizen's own acts without regard to specific intent. We submit that taking an oath of allegiance to a foreign government is such conduct.
Now, do you address that to what particular facet of the issues before us?
The first issue, Mr. Chief Justice, the question whether specific intent is a necessary element of an expatriating act.
Not to the burden of proof.
Excuse me?
Not to the burden of proof issue.
Well, that, in our view, that question has to be addressed before the burden of proof issue is addressed. that, in our view, is the touchstone of the Perez dissent and the court's opinion in Afroyim.
Mr. Ryan,
it's one which the Court of Appeals did not follow here.
Excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt you. As indicated by my question before lunch, what bothers me in this case is the applicability of this statute to this particular case. This person already was a citizen of Mexico and owed allegiance to Mexico, therefore.
Yes, he did, Justice Stewart.
In this particular case, why did his statement of allegiance to Mexico change the status quo at all?
Under Mexican law, Mexico, like the United States, does not favor dual citizenship, and it has this Certificate of Mexican Nationality, which formally recognizes the individual as a citizen of Mexico, but in the process of doing so, it requires him to surrender his allegiance to any other country, particularly that of which he is also a national. Now, the appellee has...
But before he signed anything, this person, Mr. Terrazas, if that's the way you pronounce his name, was a citizen of Mexico.
Correct.
Owed allegiance, as such, to Mexico, was also a citizen of the United States, owed allegiance as such to the United States. And whether you're not, either Mexico or the United States favors dual nationality, he was a citizen of each state.
That's correct.
Of each country.
That's correct.
And therefore, why did this signing of an allegiance, oath of allegiance to, or an affirmation of allegiance to Mexico, change the status quo at all?
Change the status quo of his dual nationality?
Yes.
Because he took the oath of allegiance to Mexico.
Well, why did that add anything to what he already owed? He was a citizen of Mexico.
Well, as a dual national, his allegiance is in something of a tension. He owes allegiance
precisely, but in fact he was, wasn't he?
In fact, he was a dual national.
Yes,
yes, sir.
Had he ever given an allegiance formally to Mexico?
Not before this act that I'm aware of.
Well, would he have lost his Mexican citizenship if he had never signed this oath of allegiance?
I don't believe so, Mr. Justice Brennan.
Then I share my brother Stewart's.
Well, he testified that he believed he had to sign this certificate or this application for Mexican nationality in order to graduate from the college that he was attending. Now, there is evidence in the record that says that was not so, but regardless of that, his testimony was that he believed he could not graduate from this school unless he signed this application for a certificate of Mexican nationality.
How does Chief Justice Warren's adjective undivided allegiance bear on this, if it does at all?
It bears on it because by applying for a certificate of Mexican nationality and by swearing his allegiance to Mexico, he demonstrates that his allegiance to the United States is certainly divided and, in fact, non-existent.
Well, fine. Didn't he already owe allegiance to Mexico if he was a citizen of Mexico?
I assume he did. As a national of Mexico, right. I assume he did. But he, for whatever reason, he thought it was to his advantage.
And you're not relying at all on his renunciation of United States citizenship in this case.
Well, as I answered to Mr. Justice Stevens earlier, we are not relying on that renunciation as the basis, because the statute, as we describe, I believe, on page 48 of our brief, has four or five specific expatriating acts. Renunciation of citizenship is one of them, but it requires it to be done. On which we are not relying.
Well, when you talk about renunciation, do you include with that the election that comes, that most dual citizens have to make sometime in their lifetime? And as I understand, under United States law as well, to choose one or the other citizenship?
I wouldn't want to say that I would call that renunciation. I don't know that I wouldn't. It would have to depend on the specific act that he did in furtherance of this election.
Well, do the laws of the United States provide for that a dual national has to elect at some time or another during his lifetime after he reaches 21 to...
Not to my knowledge, sir. Not to my knowledge.
He could have gone through his entire life being a citizen of each country.
As far as I know, yes, sir. I'm not aware of any provision of United States law that says a dual national has to elect at some point one or the other.
What could Mexico, for example, do about enforcing any obligations of citizenship except when he was perhaps within the boundaries of Mexico?
As a dual national, there probably was not much that Mexico could do.
What could we do if... the United States do, for example, about military service if he was in Mexico?
Well, in
fact,
would
he be in default if he were drafted, for example?
He was subject to the draft, and in fact, he was given a physical at one point and was subject to the normal process of the draft.
But if that occurred when he was in Mexico and he just didn't respond, he'd be in some form of AWOL, wouldn't he?
I assume he would be in some sort of trouble. Yes, sir. He was in Mexico, and in fact, I think the record shows that he did respond. He did come up and take his physical and so forth.
Well, similarly, I suppose, if he were in the United States and he were a citizen of Mexico, and Mexico had the draft, he would be in default in Mexico.
I would...
So
he
has
his
citizenship
law, yes.
In Mexico. His being a Mexican citizen does involve some obligations, some duties to the country?
I would assume that under Mexican law he does have some obligations to Mexico. That is one of the reasons that dual nationality is not a particularly favored status in any country, but in this case, as the consul told him, there was nothing illegal about it.
Mr. Ryan, what is the purpose of the affidavit on page 38 of the appendix?
On page 30A?
Yes.
That is the affidavit that the appellee signed before the consul when he came back with the forms that the consul had given him to be sent up to the State Department for a final determination of his nationality.
Well, why don't you rely on that as establishing an intention? He uses the word intention to relinquish United States citizenship.
He does. He does use that phrase. There are other statements that he made at the same time in which he says, I had no intention of giving up my citizenship. They're just squarely contradictory.
Was the other statement also sworn to?
It was not sworn.
No, why aren't those a question of fact to be resolved by the State Department?
The State Department did resolve it, although the exact weight that they placed on intention, I don't know, but they resolved that he had lost his citizenship. And the Court of Appeals has remanded this case to the District Court because it also has not passed on these conflicting statements of intention.
Was this affidavit executed for the purpose of making clear that he was not subject to draft in the United States?
No, I would not say that it was done for that purpose. It was done to forward his...
Well, you can forward papers without swearing you're not a citizen of the United States. It must have had some purpose. What was it?
The purpose, I believe, was to give the State Department a basis to determine whether he had voluntarily committed an expatriating act or not.
The purpose was to tell the State Department that he had intentionally relinquished his citizenship in the United States. That's what it says.
It does say that, and
why do you resist saying yes to my answer?
We don't rely on it in this court because the Court of Appeals made no finding on that issue in the faced the case.
What finding do you need in face of that affidavit?
There are other statements that were executed at the same time which are squarely contrary.
Were any statements subsequent to this that thought of the contrary?
No, sir. At the same time, and this is the affidavit. He also answered some questions in a questionnaire, and he also wrote out a letter in his own hand. All of which, the three documents, the affidavit and those, the questionnaire and the letter, were all sent to the State Department at the same time.
But the questionnaire has, as I think you pointed out, conflicting statements.
Yes.
And that's not sworn to, is it?
The other statements are not sworn to, as far as I know.
What I don't understand is why this affidavit doesn't settle this case.
Well, it may be that...
If intent is requisite, and if an act... Maybe evidence of intent. It seems to me, at least on the surface, perhaps I don't understand it, that you have both here. He went to Mexico, went to school there, swore in a document that hasn't been repudiated, so far as I know, that it was his intention to relinquish his United States citizenship.
If this court should hold that intent is required, it may well be that we will argue in the district court that there is only evidence of intent that is needed. But we have not taken that position here because the Court of Appeals announced this requirement in this case for the first time and then remanded to the district court for findings of fact on that issue. We did not want to come up here and ask this court to make findings of fact as to whether he did or did not have an intention when the Court of Appeals has not done so and, in fact, remanded to the district court for precisely that purpose, stating that credibility was an issue.
Well, does the State Department have a fact-finding process for determining these things, or do they go directly de novo to the district court?
There is the determination is made in the first instance on the papers that are submitted, and then there is an administrative appeal if the individual wants it, in which there is a live testimony taken.
Facts were found there, were they not?
Yes, but the trial in the district court was de novo. This was not a review of the State Department record. There is a statutory right to a de novo trial, and that was done here. I would like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Mr. Dutkowski.
Mr. Chief Justice, members of the court, please the court, the issue to be determined, as we understand it, is whether a native-born American citizen can be denaturalized or denuded of his American citizenship by a minimum standard of proof equal to or less than that of a simple negligence case. We believe also that Addington versus Texas is dispositive of this particular issue. The court considered the applicability of the 14th Amendment to the standard of proof in Addington.
Now, when you say less than in an ordinary negligence case, is that an issue here?
Well, when you talk about preponderance of the evidence, when the reviewing court looks at preponderance of the evidence, the reviewing court looks to determine if there's one scintilla of evidence that will sustain the verdict of the district court. If they find that scintilla of evidence, then they sustain the verdict. Now, that may or may not have actually been a preponderance. That's the reason I use the word less.
Well, in Addington, someone was being incarcerated.
That's correct.
Your client isn't being incarcerated.
Our client is worse than being incarcerated. Our client is losing the right to have rights, the most valued right
of
an American citizen.
Well, that's just a lot of kind of rhetoric, isn't it?
No, it's not.
He is not forbidden to move any number of places that he wants to the way the person Addington was, who was confined within the walls of an institution.
Oh, but he's not only confined, but he's confined without the walls of the United States because, not being a citizen, he doesn't have the right to American citizenship. He could very well be barred from entry into the country.
Well, but he can go anywhere else in the world he wants to.
But he's born here. He's a native-born American. He was born within sight of this courthouse in
Well, can't he come in here with a visa?
But that is still a matter of privilege. It is not a matter of right. And it takes away the most valued right that the courts have consistently held from Afram, Nishigawa, Perez, you name it. The courts
I think you would say it. There has to proof has to be beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, I would like to see proof beyond a reasonable doubt. I would like to see the most stringent proof required rather than the standard of clear, convincing, and unequivocal. As pointed out in the Addington case, there were three standards of proof that were determined. The first standard of proof was the minimum standard, which was preponderance. This involves cases where society really doesn't have much at stake. Then you have the cases where society has a great deal at stake and cases which the risk of error can't be tolerated, and those primarily are the criminal cases. Then you have the middle ground cases, and they're divided into two basic sections. The first section is the private case, where you have civil fraud, an action to declare a child born in wedlock illegitimate, an action to enforce an oral contract to make a bequest. These we apply the standard of clear and convincing. Then we have the more public cases, which Addington talked about, the deportation case, the denaturalization case, the civil commitment case, and we believe the expatriation case. Important here.
Why would your client sign the affidavit Mr. Justice Powell referred to?
The reason my client signed the affidavit was he was frightened. This is a young man.
Well, is the question of voluntariness in the case?
Yes, sir. It certainly is.
He was 22, college educated, fluent in Spanish.
Well, we have to go back.
I mean, do you agree with all that?
No. Our client signed the affidavit. Our client signed an application for a certificate of Mexican nationality in his home in Niles, Michigan, sometime in 1970. We've got a number of dates. Consul this morning said September 1970. Mrs. Alberia testified November 1970. The court found August 3rd. Mr. Parsons said April 3rd. We don't even know when the event occurred. In addition to that, the district court was presented with another application for certificate of Mexican nationality. This certificate of Mexican nationality did not even bear the plaintiff's signature. This had his name spelled wrong, and the name...
Yes, but the affidavit, I go back to it. It was in November of 71.
That's correct.
When he was a year older.
That's correct.
I further swear the act mentioned above was my free and voluntary act.
That's correct. That's what he said.
And that no influence, compulsion, force, or duress was exerted upon me by any other person, and that it was done with the intention of relinquishing my United States citizenship.
Unfortunately, that is not a true statement of what actually occurred. This young man came to the consular office after having been at a party. He was told that he had committed an overt act of treason, and he had to go to the government, the consular, C-O-N-S-U-L, rather than C-O-U-N-S-E-L, to get a determination of his citizenship. The documents he signed said registration. This young man was frightened. His father had died a short while before this, and he put himself in their hands, and he signed the documents. You can see, if you look at Exhibit 14A, exactly the type of pressure that he was under.
Would you have any case of Perez against Brownell were the law?
I'm sorry.
Would you have any case if Perez against Brownell were the law?
Yes, I think I would.
Under what ground?
Under the 14th Amendment and the history of the 14th Amendment cited in Afram. The 14th Amendment...
Afram overruled Perez.
That's correct. That's correct.
I'm saying if Perez against Brownell were the law.
I would think so. I think that even with Perez versus Brownell being the law, we have a different act involved. We still are involved with the question of the standard of proof to be involved. The standard of proof that's required to prove this voluntariness, and Perez versus Brownell did not abrogate the standard of voluntariness. So you still have the first step is to prove voluntariness. The second step is to prove what in fact he did. And these burdens are on the government. In order to prove what anybody did, you have to prove certain things. One, intent. Two, what happened? Where it happened?
Who was present? You've got to prove some type of foundation. The record here is totally devoid of any foundation. And when we look at the 14th Amendment and look at the history of the 14th Amendment, as indicated by the Ephraim case, the intention of the Citizenship Clause of the 14th Amendment was to prevent exactly what has happened in this particular case. And getting back to Addington again, we have to weigh two things. What error can we constitutionally allow to occur, and the relative importance of society? And we submit that the relative importance of society in this particular situation is supreme. We also point out...
Well, you would be satisfied with the Addington standard?
I would be satisfied. Well, I personally would want beyond a reasonable doubt. But if it's all I could get, is I would take the Addington standard.
Now, what is the affidavit that you referred to? Tell me about the setting of the one that you identified as 14A.
Right.
In that one, he said, and it's obviously more in the nature of a letter, not a form of some kind, I feel more Mexican than American. I want to stay and live here. I plan on marrying a Mexican girl. I've learned what a great country Mexico is. I feel part of Mexico. I have many relatives here. I want to be near them. Even my taste in foods are Mexican. I could not lead a double life anymore. Now, that last sounds as though he's saying informally he doesn't want dual citizenship anymore, doesn't it?
Well, 14A is not reproduced. 14 is reproduced. 14 is the product of 14A.
Did he write that?
He wrote it under the guidance of the consular officials. 14A, the testimony relative to the 14A was that he prepared a document, and then a consular official, who happened to be a Mexican national, proceeded to edit that document, taking out many of his statements. One of the statements was that he had been told by a consular official that he had committed an overt or treasonable act. So this kid was scared to death. He believed that he had to do specifically what his attorney told him, what his counsel told him. And on that basis, because of this fiduciary relationship that was imposed upon him, or he believed that had occurred, he was misled and led to sign documents that were not in accord with objective reality. And this does not or should not be sufficient to take away his citizenship.
This does not read, at least in my experience, like something that someone told him to write. It looks like the candid expressions of a person who's trying to state the facts.
Well, I can only tell you, Your Honor, that 14A has a particular statement, and it does have the statement that he had been told by a consular official that he had committed an overt or treasonable act.
Excuse me, counsel. Am I looking at the same thing? Exhibit 14 at page 10A of the appellant's appendix. What are you talking about when you say 14A?
14A is the document that gave rise to Exhibit 14. Exhibit 14. Let me explain.
Where's 14A in the appendix?
14A is not reproduced in the appendix.
Oh.
We were not given the opportunity to add to the appendix. The government came to this court and said and asked this court.
Well, where is the document 14A?
It should be in the record.
But we don't have it here in any of these papers.
It is not in any of these papers. The printing of an appendix was dispensed with upon the government's motion. Then the government proceeded to print an appendix to their brief. And consequently, the documents that we asked to be produced and the sections of the testimony we asked to be produced were not, in fact, produced.
Well, you can always put them in an appendix to your brief, don't you?
Well, when we asked for our brief to be printed, we did have documents attached to that, and they were not printed with them. I understand they were photocopied, and copies of some of those documents were the clerk.
Are you suggesting that something prevented you from giving what it is you suggest is missing?
Well, how can I put it? When I sent into the court the brief for the appellant, I sent in a document that had exhibits attached to it. What was printed without adding any of my exhibits. Among the exhibits that I had attached were statements of Mrs. Iberia taken at trial, where she admitted the alteration of his document and the editing of his document. And
is that the thing you sent into the court, the
yes,
green
this,
thing?
Yes, this is a photocopy of what I sent into the court.
Well, but that certainly doesn't comply with our rules as to size or anything else, does
well,
it?
We were granted leave to proceed as a pauper. And we proceeded to send in our brief to the court, and the court printed our brief. And what came out was this brief, which does comply.
Did you ask that these other items be printed?
I sent it, and then I called the clerk's office afterward, and I asked the clerk's office what happened to my exhibits that were attached, and I was told that they were photocopied and copies were given to each of the justices.
And that's what we have here.
That's correct. I assume that those are...
Well,
those
it says are appendix there. To brief for the appellee.
I assume that is it. That's correct.
Well, now, can you tell us in this document where 14A is?
No, I did not reproduce 14A because there's only one copy of 14A, and 14A is something that cannot be entirely reproduced because the fact what it has in there are many colored pencil marks and scratch marks.
Couldn't it be typed and reproduced
well,
in that way?
You still can't reproduce the colors.
Well, you're relying on 14A for something, aren't you?
Yes, I'm relying upon...
Well, how does it help us if we don't have it?
Well, I did produce many of the pages that were involved in 14A. I did not reduce, but I did have testimony in connection with it, and I reproduced the sections of the testimony where it was discussed and where Mrs. Iberia testified as to what she had done. And we take the position that in her editing his document, she showed exactly the power that she had over him or that the consular official had over him. I'm sorry I didn't produce 14A, but I had no ability to do so. And
what is 14A?
14A is the questionnaire. It's the original questionnaire, which eventually became 14, and 14 was produced mm-hmm. for the court by the appellant.
I see.
Okay.
14A was, and you say it doesn't exist as a...
Well, it exists in the record. There's only one copy of it, which is the original.
Where is that?
The record.
That is in the record.
Here?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. I thought you said a minute ago it wasn't here.
No. I don't have it in the documents that I produced for the court. But it is in the actual trial record that was brought up to this court. There's one concession that's made, which is part of the weighing factor that goes along with the statement of the court in Addington. Addington made a statement that the function of the legal process and the burden of proof as part of it was to minimize the risk of an erroneous decision. And on page 16 of Mr. Vance's jurisdictional statement, in a footnote, I believe it's footnote 11, Mr. Vance concedes that the burden of proof on a given issue may be dispositive of the issue. Now, expatriation is a right that's given to an individual citizen. It is not a right given to the Department of State or government. It is a right which must be exercised voluntarily by the citizen. Voluntary means voluntary. It doesn't mean negligent. It doesn't mean res ipsa loquitur like occurred in this case. It does not mean punishment for a crime. If I'm the worst person in the world, it's no right to take away my citizenship. Punish me for the crime, but don't take away my citizenship. It does not...
You concede that it can be an act voluntarily done inconsistent with allegiance to the country, without necessarily also having the specific intent to renounce citizenship.
Well, if there's no intent to do the act, it cannot be voluntary.
No, but if there's intent to do the act, but not the intent to specifically renounce citizenship.
Well, you can't make that broad a statement. If Congress should declare that wearing a red shirt should be an act of expatriation, The fact red shirt has no relationship to citizenship. Consequently, I can wear a red shirt until the sun sets in the east. And still, I will not do an act which I should be expatriated for.
What about enlisting in the army of a foreign country?
Well, it depends on the circumstance. In Nishikawa, where there's coercion, absolutely not.
What about where there's no coercion?
Where there's no coercion, we've allowed Americans to enlist in the army of Israel, and we have not expatriated them.
What was the expatriation Perez against Brownell?
Voting.
That was voting.
And was there a finding there that was done with a conscious intent to relinquish citizenship?
I think it's implicit in the court's decision, and I think that they did feel that that was such an act that it did have a conscious intent, because the fact that when you vote in a foreign election, if I were to vote in the election in Mexico, for instance, I would be involved in the intimate process of government in Mexico. And that's pretty good evidence of being an interloper or
If you enlist in the Mexican army, you may be ordered to invade the United States.
Well, that is a problem that does exist. And it then comes in the questions of coercion. This is the reason this area of voluntariness is so very important. And that's the reason we really have to determine as to, and on a case-by-case basis, what the act was, why it was done, where it was done, how it was done, and who was present. It cannot be a secret type of situation. It cannot be a situation that only I know what I have done, or only you and I know what I have done. It must be some formal act, and the statute itself does say formal.
Well, you have dual citizenship. There's a great difference between giving up one there, isn't it?
Oh, yes. When you have dual citizenship, I have a vested right in both my American citizenship and my other citizenship, and only I should have the right to give it up as an individual who's a member of free.
Is, couldn't you do something there that if you had just had one citizenship, you wouldn't have any trouble?
That's right. If I had just one citizenship, that's true. Where I have dual citizenship.
Well, you had that problem.
Well, I have made any change in my status, Mr. Terrazas. Did not change the situation.
Why didn't he file that affidavit?
The only explanation for it is stupidity. And the coercion or the indication by the consular official that this was the right thing to do.
Well, reading the parts that I just read to you, does that sound like something dictated by someone else, or does it sound like a person who sits down and writes out his thoughts?
Well, why, as one lawyer to another, what we have in many situations is a lawyer suggests sometimes the manner in which one is going to present a particular fact situation.
Including his statement that not only did he like the people and that he had a lot of relatives, but that he even liked Mexican food better than American
food.
Well,
that's still not expatriation.
No, but we're probing for intent. And
that's right.
These things sound quite sincere. And
they may sound sincere, but they're not necessarily content. Intent of giving up one citizenship. I like Swedish cooking.
Well, you say dual citizenship. He almost said dual citizenship.
He does have dual citizenship.
That's
this man.
Right. Well, I mean, that's a theory that you pull down out the clear blue, is it?
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
You don't pull down, quote, dual citizenship, end quote, out of the clear blue
no,
sky.
No, this man.
You mean something when you say that.
That's right.
And so he meant something when he said it.
Certainly. He didn't
hate that he was giving up dual citizenship.
Well, he did not intend to give up his dual citizenship.
Oh, then we mean I thought you said he did.
No, he did not intend to give up his dual citizenship.
Oh, he didn't mean what he said.
He said what he said in those statements because it was suggested to him that that was the thing to say. That was what the Department of State wanted to hear. So he said it.
Including the statement, I could not lead a double life anymore. There comes a time in everyone's life when he has to sit down and decide what he wants to do with his life. I did this and decided my future happiness was here in Mexico. For that reason, I became a Mexican.
I believe so, because he was told that he had committed an overt act of treason against the United States government, he would never be allowed to go home.
What was the nature of the act?
The act? We don't know what the act was. It may very well have been a third person's act. There is no evidence in the record that the forged certificate, the forged application for certificate of Mexican nationality did not promulgate the certificate of Mexican nationality. When Mr. Terrazas appeared at the consulate in Monterrey, Mexico, and he told Mr. Parsons that he had in his possession a certificate of Mexican nationality, Mr. Parsons said to him, "That's it. You are no longer an American citizen. You have committed an expatriating act. We have to document your case. I can't make that determination." And when Parsons was asked about it, what did he say? He said Mr. Terrazas was surprised and Mr. Terrazas did not know that he had expatriated himself. How can an act be voluntary if you don't know what you have done? And again, getting to this burden of proof issue, we still have the situation that even in the most simple case, if I want to prove that I've spoken before the Supreme Court, I must still be able to have somebody testify what was done, when it was done, where it was done, who was present. And in a case like this, I have to prove scienter. When dealing with something as important as expatriation, we're entitled to know with specificity. The government said we took an oath of allegiance. Mexico does not have an oath of allegiance. Mexico has no oath whatsoever. This is admitted by Parsons. This is admitted by the government. Consequently, we couldn't even take an oath. We're accused of taking a bite out of the apple, and then, in the reply brief, we're accused of taking a bite out of an orange. The two are distinct situations.
You may know.
I'm sorry? He went to school down in Mexico. Many Americans have gone to school down in Mexico. And many...
Many?
Many. I believe it used to be...
Good, because many goes anywhere between 1 and 18 trillion, doesn't it?
That's correct.
Yeah, okay, I agree.
And then he went to medical school down in Mexico. In fact, it used to be recommended that that was a place to get a degree.
Well, wasn't the application he signed an application for a certificate of Mexican nationality?
It was a document...
In 1970?
It was a document that was signed in blank. It did not contain the words that my brother said it did. It did not contain a specific renunciation of...
Well, did he apply for a certificate of Mexican nationality or not?
He signed a document which his father sent to his Uncle George, who was a Mexican official, and that blossomed somehow into a certificate of Mexican nationality. The document is not rationally distinguishable from the document signed by Mr. Burns in the Matheson case, which occurred essentially the same time.
Well, did somebody issue him a certificate of Mexican nationality?
The Mexican government issued a certificate of Mexican nationality.
And what did that certificate have in it?
That evidenced his Mexican citizenship, which he had already.
And what else did it evidence?
In my opinion, it's all...
Well, it says that he has expressly renounced all rights inherent to other nationalities.
Well, it does say
that's
that.
That's what that certificate says.
It does say that, and so...
And so that was an official certificate, wasn't it?
There's no question about it.
And he had applied for such an official certificate, hadn't he?
Well,
had he or hadn't he?
He signed a document in blank, and a document with a forged signature...
Well, at least the government thought he had applied for it. The Mexican government thought...
Well, the Mexican government did, yes.
And I suppose that if the application hadn't had in it this renunciation, he never would have gotten the certificate.
I don't know. Mrs. Burns did.
Well, the certificate recites that he has made this renunciation.
Well, the certificate does say that, but we do not know how that certificate was obtained. No evidence was proven as to how this...
Did you ever make any effort to send it back when he saw that it contained a renunciation?
No, he did not send it. He did not send it back. He didn't even think about it. He had the document which got him his grades from school, and that's all he was interested in. This was the sole crux of what, in fact, he was interested in.
Mr. Dukowski, you said that you didn't know and none of us knew what brought all this about. Could it have been they found out that he was in Mexico posing as a Mexican citizen?
No.
You sure that's
yes.
not true?
Yes, he went to school.
Is there anything in the record that proves that?
There is nothing in the record that proves...
Because he said his uncle was a big Mexican official.
That's right. His uncle was a Mexican official. His mother lives here.
Could that be the great treason point they're talking about?
I don't know where they got the idea of treason. I don't know where they got the res ipsa loquitur approach to this matter. What we're asking this court to do, is to declare that statute unconstitutional, require voluntariness, and require specifically that the government prove what happened, how it happened, who was present, the scienter.
Did you raise any question about the constitutionality of the provision that taking an oath of allegiance to a foreign power shall be an expatriating act in view of the fact that I understand your position to be that one can be a citizen of more than one country at a time?
I believe that statute is unconstitutional because I don't think it has any relationship at all to...
Doesn't it necessarily follow that if your basic position is right, that you must prove specific intent to relinquish citizenship, that the statute, the basic underlying statute is unconstitutional?
The basic underlying statute does not have to be unconstitutional to sustain my position.
Seems to me it's an inevitable consequence of your position, though.
I'm sorry.
It seems to me it follows logically if we should adopt your position. Because one can be a citizen of two countries.
That's correct.
And if you must prove a specific intent to renounce and so forth, and if you fail to prove that, the mere taking an oath of allegiance to another country should not be a constitutionally permissible basis for revoking citizenship.
I think it does follow, and I think the court...
Particularly for a person who is a citizen already of that country.
That's correct.
But you wouldn't suggest that these two cases are the same, would you? You go and you apply for a certificate of Mexican citizenship. In the one case, you sign a piece of paper that says, I swear allegiance to Mexico. And the other piece of, say the other fellow, another fellow, signs a piece of paper that says, I swear allegiance to Mexico, and I renounce my allegiance to the United States. Now, in the second case, there certainly is an intent that is connected with swearing allegiance to Mexico that isn't present in the first.
Well, except for the fact that our...
Well, you wouldn't say the two cases are the same, would you?
They're not identical, but our court and our State Department has said in order to renounce, you've got to do it in particular manner so that that intent is clearly made possible. So in that sense, because...
Well, I know, but you're not relying, you wouldn't be relying on the renunciation as a separate matter.
That's
but
correct.
You would be relying on the renunciation in order to inform you as to what the intent was in connection with the swearing of allegiance.
Right, that's true. But I want to point out, there was no oath in this case because there was no oath possible. We're asking this court to once and for all end this case. It's gone far enough. We fought since 1971 to the present time. We're asking this court, at the very least, to declare Lawrence Terrazas a citizen of the United States. Thank you.
I would like to clear up the status of this Exhibit 14 and 14A. But before I do that, I would like to be very frank with this Court as to the precise problem that the United States sees in the Court of Appeals decision. That decision, as I stated, requires that the United States prove, by clear and convincing evidence, a specific intent to surrender citizenship. It is the combination of those two requirements that creates the dilemma to which I referred earlier. Should this Court hold, as we believe it should, that specific intent is not an element of expatriation, and that expatriation can arise regardless of specific intent if the citizen performs voluntarily a statutorily designated act that demonstrates a transfer of allegiance, then in all candor, I must state that the clear and convincing standard applied to proving the commission of the act of expatriation itself is not an intolerable burden.
Well, Mr. Ryan, under prior cases, is it any of the government's business to say what, when and under what circumstances a citizen, by a statute, loses his citizenship? I thought that was a business of the citizen to give up his citizenship.
It is the business of both, because the government has a legitimate interest in knowing who is a citizen and who is not. It cannot depend on the subjective intent of
I thought you did. I thought arguably, at least under prior cases,
A citizen doesn't give up his citizenship just against his will.
The government cannot strip his citizenship away from him. That is a Freud.
Unless he actually knows that some, at the minimum, he actually knows that some act that he's performing unless he intends to or get to give up his citizenship.
That is not respectfully what a Freud holds in our view, and we ask the court not to hold that now.
Well, you haven't gotten much help out of the Court of Appeals, have you?
No, we have very little help out of
the Court of Appeals. As a matter of fact, the Courts of Appeals all read after them that way, against you.
The Second Circuit and this Seventh Circuit both have. The Ninth and the Fifth Circuit, we think, look the other way, although it's not a square holding. We discussed those cases in our brief. But it is the standard of proof here, applied in conjunction with the specific intent requirement, that creates the tough problem and the
well,
problem.
Why wouldn't you say then? Why wouldn't you say that Afrin was just wrong? Here, the United States says voting in a foreign election is an act which the government says amounts to a renunciation of your citizenship.
We don't believe Ephraim is wrong, and we're not asking this court to cut back on
Ephraim.
Well,
then why should you be able to say that swearing allegiance to a foreign government is a renunciation of your citizenship?
Because unlike voting in a foreign election, swearing allegiance to another government, especially when that is done in the context of renouncing United States citizenship, is an act that...
Yeah, but that isn't your argument. You don't even make that argument, apparently, that... swearing allegiance in connection with renunciation makes it stronger than if you just swore allegiance. That isn't the way you cast your argument, is it?
Well, I believe in our brief.
Certainly not in your brief.
Well, we said that circumstance could be taken into account, but even if it is ignored, we think that swearing allegiance to a foreign government is an act intrinsically different from simply voting in a foreign election.
You're just saying that's what the government. That's what the government says that act should mean. And I thought Afrim, arguably at least, says that we really have to have some proof of what the man subjectively intended by this act, what some government says.
It's Chief Justice Warren, sir, that I read that statement is coming from. In his
Chief
statement,
Justice Warren was in dissent.
He was, but that dissent later became the basis for
Ephraim. Well, it didn't, because that wasn't the issue in Afrim. Was it?
Ephraim was voting in an election.
In a foreign election. Yes, sir.
It was the analog of the same basic.
It was the same case as Perez. But Chief Justice Warren, in his dissent in Perez, said that there is a difference between voting in a foreign election and naturalizing oneself in a foreign state. That was the particular example he used.
So you still say that if in Afrim there had been two people and one of them had voted and one of them had sworn allegiance, the two cases would have come out differently.
Would have come out differently, yes, sir.
Even though the one who swore allegiance was already a citizen of that government.
Under the circumstances of this case, yes, he could. The individual there, and in fact,
how can it be that if you're already a citizen of Mexico, that a certificate stating that you're a citizen of Mexico changes the status?
Because under Mexican law, there are certain things that can be done only by a person holding a certificate of Mexican nationality. It is an official solemn document that you are a full-fledged citizen of Mexico.
He already was.
He was a dual national.
He was a full-fledged citizen. I don't know what half-fledged citizen is.
It is my understanding that there are certain things that a dual national cannot do in Mexico, even though his dual nationality is Mexican.
Do in Mexico legally.
I'm sorry.
Well, I mean, what are you referring?
I am referring to certain acts, and I don't. Have them specifically at hand, but there is testimony in the record, in the documents, that the Mexican government requires that those who are born dual nationals have a certificate of Mexican nationality in order to carry out certain things. For example,
a matter of proof of what was already a fact,
yes,
concededly in this case.
Well, yes, and so he perceived it to be in his interest to take out this certificate of Mexican nationality. The fact
proof
that he,
what was already a fact, i.e. that he was a citizen of Mexico and also a citizen of the United States.
It apparently was not sufficiently a fact to the Mexican government.
My only question is, how, in this case at least, can it be considered to be inconsistent with American citizenship to simply preserve the status quo?
Because he was not preserving the status quo. He was pledging his full obedience, adherence, and submission to the Mexican law.
Why don't you use the argument you've already used in part, that because in this case he not only swore allegiance, the same is said, and furthermore, I intend by this swearing of allegiance to renounce my citizenship.
Well, that is it. As my brother White's already said, you haven't relied on that throughout the
country. We have. I can make myself.
I'm wondering if you're still taking that position.
No, I will tell you precisely what my position is on that argument. The statute that says renouncing United States citizenship before a United States officer, that is an expatriating act. That is not what happened in this case, and so the government does not rely on the statute that says renunciation.
No, but I asked you, there are two parts to this document. One, an oath of allegiance, and secondly, renunciation language.
Correct.
I said, would it be the same legal issue here if we left out the second half of the document, and you said yes?
I say yes right now.
You still say yes?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. The only significance that renunciation has in the context of this case is that it is a piece of evidence which the State Department and the courts could consider along with all the other evidence in the case to determine just what happened here. It is not, as we say in our brief, we are not suggesting that the renunciation is an independent legal basis because it doesn't fit the statute.
You,
it was not below, before
that.
The United States.
You aren't saying concert. That, but what if, why isn't the case different if you've got the two together than if you had just the swearing of allegiance?
If we had the renunciation of the United States.
The man swears his allegiance. So assume in this case he has sworn his allegiance, and in parenthesis he said, and furthermore, I intend by this swearing of allegiance to give up my citizenship in the United States. Close parenthesis. And then the question is, what did you intend by your swearing of allegiance? Isn't that a different case than if he just swears allegiance?
That may make it a stronger case for expatriation, but it does not change the legal basis on which the expatriation occurs, which is the swearing of allegiance, not necessarily the renunciation of American citizenship.
You hope that's the rule, but what if we need an intent?
Well, we're saying that intent is not needed.
I know you do, but what if you lose on that?
If we lose on that, then
why don't you say that intent is here?
As I said before lunch, if we lose on that issue, we may well go back to the district court and say the intent is here. But the fact is that the Court of Appeals made no finding on that issue, and we did not think it proper to come up and argue to this court that it should make a finding, which is, in fact, what I believe the appellee is doing, is asking this court to re-rake the record and make findings of fact.
The finding to be made would be in the district court in the first instance, perhaps, what is the significance of the statement of renunciation of American citizenship, and how does that bear on the first half of that point?
That, Mr. Chief Justice, that is evidence of his intent to surrender his American citizenship.
That's strong evidence, I suppose.
I would certainly argue that in the district court if it comes to that. Yes, sir. Whether it is ultimately persuasive or not, it is not the only statement of intent. There are contrary statements, and that is a matter for the district judge to make findings on in the first instance.
Very well.
With the court's leave, I could explain the situation of Exhibit 14, although my time has expired.
About 14?
Well, 14.
Is it available? It's available to us now, is it not?
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice, it is. It is in the clerk's office of the court. The original exhibits are there. What happened is, 14 and 14A are both copies of a pre-printed form called a questionnaire designed to find out what happened in an allegedly expatriating act. The vice consul in this case, when he first met the appellee, said, here, take this questionnaire back home and fill it out and bring it back to us. The appellee did so. He came back and he filled it out. Unfortunately, although not unreasonably, he proceeded on the answering the questions as if he had been naturalized as a Mexican citizen, which in fact he had not. He was a Mexican citizen by birth. The consular officer, the consular assistant, Maria Ibarra, testified, and this is all in the record, there's no Svengali influence here, that she sat down with Mr. Terrazas and she went through question by question. She said, actually, you're not a naturalized citizen, you're a native-born citizen, so this question shouldn't be answered. She went through page by page while he was there. He never said anything in response. He just took her instructions as to the proper way of filling out the form. She said, fine, now that you understand this, please take this fresh form home and complete it with the correct questions answered, which he did. None of this business about I feel more Mexican than American or so forth was ever dictated in any way, shape, or form by anyone in the consul. The record simply doesn't support that. This question of treason, there is absolutely no evidence in the record that anyone told him that he was committing a treasonous act. In fact, the vice consul flatly and repeatedly denied that he had said any such thing. The only place that ever shows up is in various statements outside the record that the or outside the trial testimony that the appellee has made. I would be distressed if this court were to characterize the record as my opponent has characterized it, because I think those facts are simply not in the record. The record is a four-volume transcript and a number of documents which we believe are self-explanatory. This appellee was not forced or coerced or hounded by any
employee. I think we have your point now with respect
Thank
to that.
You, Chief Justice.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in Village of...